Welcome to Creating Wealth with Jason Hartman. During this program, Jason is going to tell you some really exciting things that you probably haven't thought of before, and a new slant on investing. Fresh new approaches to America's best investment that will enable you to create more wealth and happiness than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine, self-made multimillionaire who not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. He's been a successful investor for 20 years and currently owns properties in 11 states and 17 cities. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to financial freedom. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, and this is episode number 168. We're using a new microphone today that we're trying out, so I hope it sounds good. We will see, and if not, we'll convert back to the old system. We've got probably, $10,000 or so worth of recording equipment, so we're constantly trying out different things to make sure the show sounds good for you, our listeners. So today we're going to talk about some exciting real estate and financial stuff. We're going to talk about investing in mobile home parks, and I've got a great guest with me here in a moment that we have coming up. And before we get into that, a couple quick announcements and a quick discussion about precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, and kind of the precious metals distinction. I've made a couple new distinctions on that I wanted to share with you that you haven't heard me talk about in the past. Before we get into that, I want to make sure that you join us for our event on May 22nd. It is at a new location. We have not been at this location before, and that is the Newport Beach Marriott Hotel, the Bayview or the Back Bay Marriott Hotel. It's kind of a resort location, so it should be very nice. And that'll be May 22nd, so make sure you join us for that. Call one of our investment counselors, go to the website jasonhartman.com, get signed up right away, and take advantage of that because we do not do as many events as we used to. So these are kind of rare, and they update and change more and more between each event because we're doing them less often. And we told you we would be doing them less often as we are trying to convert more and more of the business to digital media, podcasting, radio shows, etc. The other thing is, in addition to that event, before we get into the discussion of investments in precious metals and then mobile home parks, is be sure you join our text club. Now, a lot of you have already done this. We will have some very special promotions that go out exclusively to text club members, and you've got to do this from your cell phone. There's no other way to do it. From your cell phone, text to this number, 411, like information, 411, 411-247, like 24/7, 411-247. And again, this only works for United States and Canadian listeners. We will have other numbers and so forth for international listeners later. And just type in to that text the keyword Jason, my name, and then a space and your name, and then your email address. So again, 411-247, and then keyword Jason, and then just your first name, and then your email address, and put spaces between those three items. So do that, and be sure to join us on the 22nd of May. And remember, if you've attended the Creating Wealth event before, Creating Wealth in Today's Economy, as many thousands of people have, and we have rave reviews on that event, we recommend that you re-audit the class, and you can re-audit it again on a space available basis for no charge. As long as we have space available, just call our office, talk with one of our investment counselors to sign up as a re-audit. We recommend that you do this every 6 months because things change and you need a refresher, you need an update, you need to stay current on the latest and greatest news. And of course, our office phone number is 714-820-4200, 714-820-4200. Okay, without further ado, so you've heard me talk about investments in gold and silver and why I am not a gold bug, why I think that the precious metals are probably better than fiat money, than dollar bills, but not much better than anything else. It's been said, and I say it freely, not being a gold bug, not being an advocate of precious metals investing, I think it is okay. I think it is mediocre, but I don't think it is really an investment. Here's why. 6 billion people on Earth probably will agree with the statement that gold and silver are money. And you know what? I would agree with that too. But guess what? Money does not qualify as an investment. Money is simply a store of wealth. It is a savings. Whereas fiat dollars or any fiat currency around the world, whether it be rubles or yen or pesos or euros or dollars, anything, it is fiat money. So it's backed by nothing more than a promise. And that promise gets broken by central banks and governments as they keep printing more of it and debasing the value of the currency. So do I think it's better to save money in gold and silver than dollars? Yeah, probably, because I generally agree that the dollar is in for a long-term loss in value, and I believe that pretty much every other currency on Earth, it's all man-made, it's all fiat. Fiat, of course, just means by authority, by decree, which is meaningless, basically. It gets debased, and so it is subject to inflation. And inflation devalues purchasing power. And so I have stated my five very unique reasons that gold and silver, or any precious metal for that matter, is just a mediocre thing. It's not even an investment. It's just money. Big deal. Get over it. It's kind of like saying life insurance is an investment. No, I don't think it's an investment at all. I think life insurance is a lousy investment. Please hear me. I am so fed up with these financial firms and financial advisors that go out and they sell life insurance, which pays gigantic commissions, by the way. They peddle it as though it's an investment. It's just life insurance. Now, you may need life insurance, so if you do, buy yourself a simple term life insurance policy. But that doesn't mean you should consider it an investment, because the last thing these life insurance companies or financial advisors that peddle this stuff want you to understand is that the devaluation of those benefits of those hybrid products that are universal life, whole life, will be completely debased by inflation. Do you really think some big insurance company with teams of MBAs and geniuses and financial engineers, do you think they're really going to sell you something where they're going to lose money? Of course they're not. And then you see these life insurance companies, they turn around and what do with your premiums? They buy, guess what? Income property. What you should be buying in the first place. So cut out the middleman, get yourself a term life insurance policy if you need life insurance, but do not consider an investment. Back to gold and silver, money. Money is not an investment, it's simply a store of wealth. So I have stated my five very unique reasons many times over that gold and silver do not qualify as an investment. Number one, and by the way, the reason I'm going over these is because I'm adding two new ones that you haven't heard me talk about before. There are now seven reasons. No financing, number one. Bad reason, of course. With income property, you can finance it. You can use OPM, other people's money, leverage to accelerate wealth creation. No tax benefits, whereas income property is the most tax-favored asset in America. No renters. Nobody will rent out your gold bars, your silver coins, or anything like that. They don't produce any income. Number four, they're subject to confiscation. And then I hear you saying, that can't happen in America. Well, guess what? It already did happen in America in 1933. So they are subject to confiscation. Then I hear the gold bugs say things like this. Well, numismatic coins like St. Gaudens and other collectible numismatic coins are not subject to confiscation. They're the non-confiscatable coin, they say. Well, folks, that's just a stupid law. And guess what? The government changes its mind all the time about its stupid laws. So to me, that is meaningless. Fact is, subject to confiscation, period, end of discussion. Number five, gold, silver, other precious metals, subject to manipulation. The last things governments and central banks want you to do is own precious metals. Why is that the last thing they want you to do? Because it is flying in the face of their fiat currency that they are trying to get you to believe in and to buy into. They want to suppress the value of gold and silver and other metals so that they make their fiat paper currencies more valuable. So those are the five reasons. Now, if you've been a listener to the show in the last 167 episodes, you've heard me talk about those five reasons. But guess what? I failed to mention two more very significant reasons that gold and silver do not qualify in my book as an investment. Number six, new reason here, high transaction costs. What do I mean by that? Well, they always say, the gold bugs will say, gold and silver, they're easy to buy, they're easy to sell, they're very liquid. And that's true, sort of not. Why not? Well, because the dealers that say they will guarantee to buy anything you buy back from you, if they're still in business, they'll buy your coins back or your gold bars back, right? But guess what? They charge you a giant handling fee, usually in the neighborhood of 10% or more. I'll give you an example. I talked to one of them today. Now, the spot price of gold today, as I am recording, or at the time I checked, which was a few hours ago, was $1,171 per ounce. But they will sell you Gold Eagle coins for $1,255 per ounce. And by the time they ship them to you with the shipping cost, those coins are $1,274 each. So you are paying more than $100 over the spot price to buy the coin. And guess what? If you want to get rid of it and liquidate it, you need to ship it back to them, and you need to worry that, in my opinion, that it gets there, that shipment. Of course, you can insure it, but there's a lot of games that can be played there and a lot of theft and fraud that can happen. You ship it back to them, and what if you put 10 coins in the box and they say, well, there were only 9 in here, and they send you your money for 9 of them, right? Well, guess what else? You're going to pay your shipping costs, you're going to pay your insurance costs, assume it gets there okay, and assume that you get paid. Well, guess what? They will only give you the spot price and what they call the meltdown value, which means they take another 1.5% off of the spot price. So you have to pay for insurance, shipping, and a 1.5% premium to give them back the coins. So, high transaction costs. Now, usually, one of the things people say that they say bad about income property, about real estate, is that, well, it's very illiquid. It has high transaction costs. And you've heard me address this on prior shows. But think about it. That illiquidity, those high transaction costs, are the very thing that give it so much stability. And that is one of the things I love about income property, that I love about real estate, is that those high transaction costs and illiquidity make the market far less volatile. Remember, low transaction costs, low friction on transactions, streamlining, and high liquidity mean volatility. And you don't want volatility in your long-term investment portfolio. Number 7, other reason that precious metals, gold, silver, etc., do not qualify as an investment in my book. Of course, I said number 2, no tax benefits. But if you're lucky enough to have a gain on these items, you are going to pay tax on that gain. Whereas with your income property, you can trade it all your life through a 1031 tax-deferred exchange. Those laws have been around for a long, long time. And it is not only the most tax-favored asset when you own it, but also it is the most tax-favored asset when you sell it, as long as you do 1031 tax-deferred exchange. So 7 reasons that the precious metals do not qualify as an investment. Now, I want you to understand something, because if tomorrow gold goes to $1,500 an ounce or $2,000 an ounce, which I want you to hear me when I say this, that may happen. You heard me say that. However, here is the distinction. The gold did not go up in value. It's just that your dollar, or whatever currency it is that you live your life in, dollars, rubles, yen, yuan, whatever, pesos, it doesn't matter. The gold or the silver did not go up in value. Your fiat currency went down in value. And you understand, if you've been listening to this show, that whole concept. It's not the nominal value of something. It is the real value. Nominal means in name only. Real means purchasing power. What can you really buy for it? And of course, the great thing about income property, you go and you stack up long-term 30-year, 3-decade-long debt on that property, and as the dollar sinks or other fiat currencies sink in value, wow, you have just become so rich because your debt was paid off for free. This is the little-known wealth creator that most people simply do not understand. Plus, of course, the packaged commodities, the asset, go up in value when that inflation occurs. Anyway, we've discussed that before. Won't get into it today. Let's go and let's talk about one of my favorite investment classes, mobile home parks. Now, if you are interested in investing in mobile home parks, you need a little more money to do it usually, but talk to one of our investment counselors at my company, Platinum Properties Investor Network. And again, they can help you source mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, apartment buildings. Of course, the core of the business, single-family homes in 43 markets nationwide. None of the bubble markets. We still think there's some real pain coming up for the bubble markets like California. Again, many markets, if you geographically diversify, have a very good future in our opinion. All real estate is local. It all depends where. Now, we have an affiliate relationship with the guest I'm about to introduce to you, and his products are on our website at jasonhartman.com. And remember, whenever you buy these products through us, we give you a nice little bonus, and that is either Platinum Bucks, a free product, Platinum Bucks that you can use to come to an event for free or with a discount. So there's a lot of advantages to buying these products through our network, because we at Platinum Properties Investor Network and my affiliated company, the Hartman Media Company, always throw in a nice little bonus for you when you buy through our affiliate relationship at the jasonhartman.com website. Anyway, I think you'll enjoy this interview. I really asked a lot of questions and got down to a lot of the nitty-gritty here. You're going to learn a lot. So here we go. We'll be back right after this.
If you want to be a successful investor, you need to learn the truth about where to invest and how to create wealth from someone who does it successfully every day. Jason Hartman. Thousands of people are growing wealthy by pulling their money out of the stock market and putting it into what has been proven year after year to be history's best investment, rental property. And Jason has developed the Creating Wealth Bootcamp. 9 hours of intensive real estate training coming to Costa Mesa, California, Saturday, May 22nd, from 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. You'll learn exactly what steps to take to begin investing in rental properties the moment you walk out the door. And it's not a bunch of esoteric theory either, just a simple, repeatable, conservative approach that can make you very wealthy. The Creating Wealth Bootcamp, just $297. Register today at www.jasonhartman.com.
It's my pleasure to welcome Dave Reynolds to the show. He has got vast experience in the acquisition and operation of mobile home and RV parks for the past, little over a decade, about 12 years now. And he's got a great ability to assess deals, cut through the hype, measure the upside and the downside risk, and make sound decisions when it comes to these investments. As you know, this is a great asset class, and it should be part of your real estate portfolio. And we're going to dig into the details of how to do it right today. Dave, welcome.
Well, thank you, Jason. I'm excited to be on the show tonight.
It's great to have you on. Tell us a little bit about your background just quickly, if you would, so all the listeners kind of know where you're coming from, and then let's get into the meat of this subject.
My parents actually owned a mobile home park when I was growing up, and I really didn't think too much of it then. I thought the mobile home park business was really nasty, and I didn't like it. I didn't like going to visit the park and all of that. Then, fast forward to my college days, and my degree is in accounting and taxation. I started doing their tax returns, and I'm seeing they're making this huge cash flow from, the mobile home park they own, actually much more money than from his day job. So, I started getting interested in mobile home parks then, and about 12 years ago, I bought my first mobile home park, and then I acquired another park, and then I flipped the second park within about 30 days, made a bunch of money on that quick flip, and from there, I started brokering parks and just buying them like crazy.
So you're a broker also, right?
I am a broker, but I do not broker.
But you do have your license.
And, I do.
And just out of curiosity, where are you coming from today? What state are you in? What state and city?
I'm in Cedar Ridge, Colorado. It's on the western slope of Colorado.
Excellent. And your first deal, just so our listeners can get an idea as to how realistic this is for people, how many spaces was your first deal? And was it mobile home or RV park? I know there is a difference. People should know.
Actually, the first deal, I want to say it had 45 mobile home spaces, and it had 11 RV spaces, so it was a little mixture.
And, like, how much was it, for example?
I bought that deal for $265,000, and it was actually the guy that I bought it from, he had bought it about 2 years before that, or maybe about a year before that, and he was defaulting on the loan. He wasn't making payments. He wasn't doing anything right, and so I inherited kind of a mess, but I just walked in and assumed the notes that he had that he hadn't been paying on. And I actually, for my down payment, it was about $65,000. And I didn't have $65,000, but I had lots of credit cards. So lo and behold, I went to the bank and cash advanced $65,000 on credit cards to buy the deal.
Oh, so yeah. Isn't that great? You're buying an asset that a lot of people would consider to be full of people who can't manage their money, and you buy it on credit cards.
Right. Yeah, the guy at the bank thought I was a complete idiot.
It's funny, but you proved him wrong, huh? So you did $65,000 completely from the credit cards? That was the down payment, right?
Yeah, the down payment was $65,000. And yes, I had about $5,000 in the bank. You know, I had a landscaping business that I sold after that, but I did have only about $5,000 in the bank, so I cash advanced $65,000.
And so was your financing for the park through the seller or through a bank? Or I know financing is tough nowadays, so I want to address that question with you.
Sure. The financing was actually, there was two notes. The guy that bought the park still had a first mortgage, or the guy that built the park, and the people that bought it from him, they sold it to the guy that I bought it from, so they carried a second mortgage for him. And so what I did is I just walked in and assumed those first two mortgages, this prior seller financing.
So nowadays, though, those were seller financed, or because a bank wouldn't let you assume those usually nowadays, right?
Typically not. There are quite a few mobile home park mortgages that were written in the last, say, 5 to 10 years that are assumable. There's a company called Bayview, Silver Hills, LaSalle, and a lot of those loans were assumable with a 1% fee. So there are quite a few of those out there, but the problem is they've been paid down quite a bit. So
right.
And you can't really put seconds on those, so it's better to get new financing or seller financing or something.
Sure. And just out of curiosity, in case there's one out there that someone comes across through one of those lenders that they want to assume them, and it makes sense, I mean, is that assumable with qualifying? I assume the bank requalifies the new borrower. Of course, the property does a lot of the qualifying, but how does that all work?
Typically, I mean, the way most of the banks that have these assumable, that wrote a lot of mobile home park mortgages, their requirement is that they want the new buyer to be as good or better as the previous borrower. And in most cases, the previous borrower isn't really that, if they have a big mortgage and they bought it 3 or 4 years ago, they probably bought it for very little down and, that type of stuff. So the new borrowers are usually better off than the prior borrowers anyways. So you just have to, you have to have good credit scores. You can't be borrowing the down payment. Typically, like any other type of a loan assumption, it's
right.
Different for mobile home parks.
Can't put the down payment on your credit card.
They'd frown on that.
Right, yeah, I hear you. So, Dave, how did you add value to that first deal you did? You said you flipped it and you made some good money, and that really gave you the launch pad to make a huge business out of this. You're quite a success story. My hat's off to you. Yeah, how'd you add the value to the park?
Well, the first deal, there was a bunch of what we call in the business park-owned homes, and that's where the park owns the mobile homes as well. And so what we did is we tried to convert all those park-owned mobile homes into just space rent only. And by doing that, we attracted better tenants, people that were more stable in the park, and we tried to increase the actual lot rent. And what that did was, give us a better tenant base, but also gave us more stability, a lower expense ratio, and really a higher net income. And, a much easier to manage asset. Because when you own the homes, it's just like a lot of the other, businesses like apartments and single family where, people tear everything up and you have to go in and fix it after everybody leaves. So with mobile home parks, what you really want to do is get to just renting the land or the dirt. By increasing the rent and just cleaning the place up, we were able to, about 2.5 years actually at that one, we sold about 2.5 years later.
So you don't like owning. Now, there's, of course, a lot of my listeners are familiar with the concept of Lonnie deals, where people are more, they may or may not own the park, but they own mobile homes. And you don't like being in the structure business, it sounds like. You really like being in the dirt business, the pads, right?
Correct.
Because you don't like to mess around with the details of that.
Right, for sure. Yeah, the problem that we've seen with, the Lonnie deal business model is that if you don't own the park and your home becomes vacant or the renters tear it up, then you're still responsible for that lot rent. So you really, as a Lonnie dealer, you're ultimately making money for the park owner because you're paying the lot rent. It's really kind of the worst of both worlds. You don't own the land, but you're renting the home that you still have to pay lot rent on if your tenant doesn't pay you.
The only thing, though, is when you own a lot of this stuff, now you may have a brick-and-mortar house on it, but you guys have a great revenue opportunity, and we're going to explore that more, but you don't get much write-off in terms of depreciation because you really don't own any structures or minimal structures, right?
Well, actually you have a bet. You can depreciate better for mobile home parks than you can for apartments and single-family. Because what you're depreciating is land improvements, and you know, under the IRS code, land improvements are depreciated over 15 years, and so you know, you pretty much have land and land improvements.
Well, give us an example, if you would, Dave, of the land improvements on a park. I mean, they're concrete pads, maybe there's a pool, maybe there's some landscape, maybe there's a little house there or a community center, clubhouse. What else?
Well, the big things would be the roads, the electric lines, the water lines, the sewer lines, the gas lines, and all of that type of stuff, the bushes.
And that's all a 15-year schedule, huh?
15-year schedule.
That's better. You're right. Wow.
Yeah.
But is the ratio is favorable? I mean, because when you have, like, if you had an apartment building that was, say, $1 million apartment building compared to $1 million mobile home park, the improvement value on the apartment building might be 80%, for example. Whereas how much really juice do you get out of those land improvements?
Well, this is nothing set in stone, but what I typically do is 70% is land improvements and 30% is land. So it's, you know, very similar, and then you're depreciating much faster. You know, if there is a clubhouse or a single-family home or something like that on that property, then you will, you know, be stuck with depreciating that over 28.5 years or 31.5 years, that part of it. But usually the big part is, you know, because it costs a lot of money to run all those utilities and streets. And
sure. And you can just buy an existing park, inherit that from the former owner when you buy it, and then you start your 15-year depreciation schedule all over again, right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, that's a pretty great deal, absolutely. Now, talk to us, if you would, a little bit about some metrics. Are there certain sort of metrics that you use constantly to evaluate a deal that makes sure it makes sense?
You know, I guess one of our quick formulas is, there's actually two of them. One of them is if the actual tenants pay their own water and sewer bill directly, like to the city or, you know, other municipality. So what we do in that case is we take, if they pay their own, we take the actual number of occupied lots and multiply that by the average rent, the lot rent, and then multiply that by 70. And that usually gets you kind of where the value is of that park.
So let's just kind of, can we go through that a little bit more slowly and maybe just with like an example? Do you want to say it's $1 million park just for round number's sake?
Yeah, probably easier way to look at it would be, let's say it's a 150-unit park and there's 100 occupied lots. Let's say the average lot rent is $200 a month. So we take 100 occupied times $200 a month. So that's
$20,000.
$20,000. And then multiply that by 70, so $1.4 million.
So that's $1.4 million park, all right?
Right, yeah, and that's a rough estimate, but that's kind of a good way to, you know, initially look at it.
Sure, that's good. So that tells us what we might pay for that park, but then we've got another big opportunity here because we've got 50 unoccupied lots, right, Dave?
Correct. I mean, you know, right now, you know, those unoccupied lots are not the ultimate thing you want to have, because it is harder to fill lots with, you know, the financing and, you know, all that type of stuff. But, you know, it's definitely a great thing to have added in there because, you know, down the road, if the market turns around and people start buying a bunch of homes and bringing them in there, and you could increase, you know, to 150 lots. But, yeah, no, the problem is you just don't want to give those extra lots a lot of value when you're buying, but when you're selling, of course you want to, you know, give them some type of value.
So that's one of your metrics. That's excellent. You said there was another one that you like.
Yeah, well, you know, if the only change we would have is if the park actually pays the water and sewer and doesn't bill it back to the tenants, then we would use the factor of 60 rather than 70.
So in this example, do you want to go through that same one again?
Sure. So 100 occupied lots at $200 a month times 60, so that would be $1.2 million.
Oh, rather than $1.4 million.
Right.
So the utilities could add $200,000 to the value if you can charge for them, right?
Right. So yeah, exactly what you would be looking for as a buyer. If you see a deal like that, and you can sub-meter that water and sewer, pass that along to the tenants. You can take, you know, $1.2 million to $1.4 million overnight for about $150 a watt, because that's what it costs to sub-meter in most cases.
But then don't you have, Dave, the hassle of sort of reading all the meters and billing all the tenants for it, or do you outsource that to a third-party company?
There are opportunities to outsource that. We, you know, all the parks that I own, we do that all in-house. It's actually not that big of a deal. You know, the biggest problem you're going to have is if you're in a real cold area and just making sure the meters don't freeze up. But, you know, you just plug it into a simple Excel worksheet once a month, have your park manager go around, read the meters, and send you the readings. You plug that in, and you generate bills. And, it, you know, it's very simple. You know, it takes us about an hour or two a month in total. But, you know, then you're not paying. You're saving, you know, $2,000 or $4,000 a month, and people aren't wasting water, and it's really a good situation.
All right, good. So those are two great metrics. What else would you like listeners to know about this, and why is it so good? What are some of the things you want them to know?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, some of the top reasons, you know, to buy it, you know, that you would buy a mobile home park would be, you know, just the stability. You know, once the home's there in the park, that home's usually not going to move. So once the home's there, you may change tenants or, you know, residents, but you're never going to really change homes. And the reason for that is, you know, because it can cost from, you know, kind of a minimum of about $3,000 up to $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 to move a double wide. So, you know, people are not going to just be moving those homes around. You know, that's really, I mean, for a mobile home park owner, that's kind of the biggest thing you're looking at is, I mean, once that home's there, as long as they're paying that lot rent, that home's not really going to move.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And the laws usually, and I know it varies from state to state, kind of favor the park owner, don't they, Dave, in terms of if someone sort of abandons their home and doesn't pay, or how does that work compared to the normal residential world?
Some people think it's, you know, actually works, it's more difficult, but it really isn't. There are laws pretty much on every books, you know, each different state, and it all works differently. But, you know, if somebody does abandon the home, you know, typically the process is you send a certified letter to the last title holder, and you know, wait like 30 days, and if they don't come up and say, you know, this is my home and that type of stuff, then you can file for what's called an abandoned title, and then you file that with the state, and you know, usually 15 to 30 days later, you'll end up having the title, and then you can go and resell the home or, you know, do whatever you want with it. So, you know, it's a simple process once you learn how to do it. You know, the first one, it's always a learning experience, but, you know, and it doesn't happen that often. Typically, when somebody moves and leaves their home, they're going to sell it before they move. You know, I would say, you know, I own about 2,000 spaces right now, and we probably have, I would say, 5 to 10 homes a year that are abandoned like that.
Where do you own your parks? Like, in what states? Do you favor certain states in which to do business?
I pretty much go nationwide, but I focus more on the Midwest just because it's easier for me to manage and manage all those parks. Because I'm one of those people that don't like to fly, so I like to drive. So I take a big loop about every, you know, 2 or 3 months, either looking at the parks I own or looking for more parks to buy. So most of the states I'm in are Colorado, Nebraska, Kansas, Texas, South Dakota, Oklahoma, and so it's kind of all in that general area. But, you know, I've owned parks in California and Virginia, Ohio, all over the place. So it's not, I don't have an issue at all with, you know, owning them a long distance away.
And what do you think, do you want to talk about management for a moment in terms of some, I mean, we touched on it, but some of the best practices as far as being a good manager, and I know this is what you teach, and maybe talk about the products that we're offering, and those are available at the jasonhartman.com website, and you have a boot camp, and then you have a home study course, or you have two different home study courses, right?
Correct, yes. We have one home study course, and then we have an upgraded version where it has like a due diligence manual and some one-on-one consulting where we do, like, you bring us a deal, show it to us, and we say, well, this deal is great because of this reason or that reason, or, you know, if you buy this deal, you're going to go bankrupt. You know, don't buy this. It's a bad deal. So we actually, you know, we call that a quick deal review, and we give you some of those. So, you know, our home study course has about 1,000 pages of written material, has 54 hours of audio with my partner and I talking about all the different steps, you know, from buying parks, selling parks, managing parks, turning them around, everything you can think of. My partner, Frank, also has owned about $50 million worth of mobile home parks in the past 12 years. And, you know, what's really kind of struck us both when we really started doing this kind of stuff and writing the books and doing the audios is, even though we were in different areas in a lot of cases, all of our experiences are pretty much the same, and we've come up with the same conclusions. So, we do disagree on some things, and so you see both sides of the story sometimes too. But as far as managing mobile home parks, I guess that was the second part of your question there. We basically what we do is right now I own 18 parks. And I have one person that sits here in Colorado and kind of off-site manages all the parks. So they communicate with the on-site managers. And each park will have a what we call an on-site manager who may get as little as free rent for managing the park up to, free rent plus, a couple thousand dollars a month in fees to run the park. So our off-site managers will actually, show the lots, show homes, collect the rents, deposit the rents. They'll go around the park every day to make sure the trash is picked up, people aren't parking on their grass or have engines dismantled in their driveway, all that, all the rural things that they're supposed to abide by. They're checking out all that. So they're kind of our eyes and ears at each park. And so, we have the one centralized person that runs all those managers who run all the, basically, the residents in each park. And, with all the forms and systems that we've set up, over the years, it actually works pretty well.
And there must be a large amount of cash transacting in this business because lot rent is so cheap, and I would worry about the managers stealing. I think that's always a concern when you have lower-end people that might not be good with credit cards or bank accounts or things like that. Or do you really do it all through cashless type management? Can you do it that way?
We do it all through cashless. None of our managers are allowed to accept cash at all, ever. If they accept cash and we see it on the deposit slip, then they get reamed about it because it's so easy for the residents to get money orders, and it costs them 50 cents to get a money order. And we just do not want, not only because of managers possibly stealing, we don't want them to feel any threat to people robbing them, or we just don't want that to happen. If somebody wants to come steal a bunch of checks, okay, fine. But as long as we post no cash and don't accept cash, then we have very little theft at all. Every once in a while, a manager will come up with a crazy scheme of how they're going to try to steal $1,000 or $2,000, and they end up getting caught about a month later. And we've had it happen a few times, but all in all, as long as you have a good accounting system where they have to really disclose everything that's coming in, and you know what's coming in because you're overseeing what's actually there. And then when you actually do the trips around to the parks and count the homes and all that, all that stuff kind of blends together, and it ties back together in the end. So I would never accept cash, and we have done that in the past. And every time we accepted cash in a park, it was always ended up to be a problem at some point.
I would agree with you. And do you use like Rent Manager as your software? Because there's a lot of back-end accounting that has to go on to make sure everybody's paying. And you're dealing with a large number of tenants in this type of business that are paying a small amount of money versus fewer tenants paying a large amount of money. So you really got to have good systems, right?
Right. And, we actually, I've used Rent Manager in the past, and I think it has some great benefits, and I've used some of the other programs out there as well. But what I found that works best for us is we use Microsoft Excel, Microsoft Word, and QuickBooks, and we have it so down pat, it works so much easier for us to run our properties. But there are other solutions if you're not good with those programs. And me, I'm kind of a computer nerd, and I've got people that are computer nerds here, so we know how to create all those macros and types of stuff to make it, to basically do what those other programs would do.
Sure.
But more how we want it to work.
Right, right. Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
Are you interested in a property outside of our network? Do you need a second opinion? No problem. Let Jason's experts evaluate the deal. Our deal evaluator is only $50. For more information, go to jasonhartman.com now.
And in the management world, I'm working on a deal myself right now, and it's on I want to talk about some acquisition strategies in a moment if we could, but I'm looking at a master lease deal. And one of the clauses in the master lease is, as the quote-unquote tenant, the master tenant that's running the park, is you will not use the park for any immoral or illegal activities. And what instantly came to my mind when I saw that is, gosh, what if I've got some tenant in there that's engaged in something illegal like drugs or prostitution or, God forbid, I mean, that could be a horror story where it could invalidate my lease or violate a covenant. And I would think in the mobile home park business, you really have to keep an eye on this type of stuff. Or maybe I've just been watching too many movies. I don't know. What do you say about that?
Too many news stories.
Or too many Jerry Springer shows. I'm not sure which one, you know.
I guess I haven't seen what your master lease reads, but I guess my suggestion would be, you're the actual tenant, the master tenant, because you're subleasing the whole park, and so those individual subleases would probably, as long as you have a clause that and you enforce that you're enforcing your rules, you should be okay. But, that's, something your attorney should probably go through as well. But, as far as, we all hear that the mobile home parks get hit by the tornadoes and all the crazy people come from mobile home parks and every robbery and burglary, and, that's just not true. Not every mobile home park is 50 homes selling meth and meth labs. I've owned 60 parks, and we've had one meth lab out of all 60. So it's, you do have some really strange stories, and, those are the entertaining ones, and those are the ones that are repeated. But, you have really good people in a lot of mobile home parks that, actually are good, good hard workers, work at the auto plants and McDonald's and Walmart and several policemen, all kinds of different walks of life. And, they're actually a really, it's really kind of a unique experience if you ever live in a park, because they really kind of band together and they're like their own community. Kids all get along and stuff. So a lot of that stuff is just over generalized on the news.
Sure, sure. And that might be good, because maybe that's the reason the opportunity is here for all the investors listening to profit, because some people that don't know any better are scared away. And that does create opportunity for sure. Is there sort of a sweet spot you like in terms of deal size, number of units, amount of money, purchase price?
I got to just say a quick story about your last statement about some people getting scared away.
Sure, sure.
When I first got into the business, I told my grandma what I was going to do, and she wouldn't talk to me for 2 years.
Wow.
After I bought my first part. So, that's definitely a true statement.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, as far as a sweet spot, typically what I'm looking for is I'm looking for parks that are in the probably a minimum of about 35 to 40 spaces and up. I'm not really focusing on parks that are 500 spaces, because those are where, all the REITs and the, the cheap life insurance
institutional stuff.
Funds,
yeah.
Institutional stuff. I don't want to be buying that stuff at, six caps. So what I'm looking for is the more mom-and-pop built it, on 5 acres or 10 acres. They've owned it for 20 years or 30 or 40 years, and they're just looking to retire. And, those are the parks that really present the best opportunities, and they've been run. Usually mom-and-pop run them pretty well, but they don't run them very well as far as the net profit. So there's a lot of opportunity to go in and change a few things here and there, like raise the rents or submeter the utilities and that type of stuff to actually, you can turn some parks, from a $300,000 park into a $600,000 park with just one rent raise. We just bought a park in the Dallas metro area, 40 spaces. The rent was $90 a month, and the market rent there is about $275 a month. So we took, $90, went up to $250 all in one rent raise, and nobody even complained because they knew that's where the rent should be. But it had been $90 or less for the last, 10, 15 years. And, it's just, that was, they didn't care. They knew all the people there, and they didn't want to raise the rent. So, there's great opportunities there. As far as, locations, you want to stay away from areas that, like most real estate, you don't want one-horse towns or, two rural type stuff. The big thing with mobile home parks, one of the biggest things I look at is, what is the occupancy of all the parks in town? So if you're buying a park that's, say, 50 spaces with 25 vacant spaces, so 50% occupied, but everybody else in town is 100% occupied, then you have, you know, you don't have a lot of competition there because they're already occupied. But if you're buying, you know, the same park and everybody else is half occupied, then you have all the other parks are vying for that next customer.
When it comes to rent increases, it sort of amazes me in the mobile home park business how totally cheap these rents are. I mean, when you say Dallas for $90 a month and
right.
someone could buy a home, a mobile home that they can stick on that spot for $3,000 to $5,000 and above, and probably a nice one for $20,000, right? I don't know, is my pricing right there?
Yeah, I mean, you can get a nice home, a nice repo for $10,000.
Yeah, right. And so you can get a sort of a crummy one for $3,000 to $5,000, the lower end of the market. It first of all, makes me wonder why there is a homelessness problem. Because people can live inexpensively in a lot of cases, even if there was a government program. But what I wonder on rent increases is, do some of the people have like different leases and different expiration dates and where you can't really do those rent increases and it becomes problematic and spotty?
Typically, when you buy a park, unless it's owned by like kind of an investor mentality person, somebody that's, you know, owns a bunch of real estate and has leases and all that, most of the time when you buy a park from mom and pop, they haven't rewritten a lease in 15 or 20 years. So it's like you're going in with no lease. So you can basically go in, you know, based on what state it is. Like in Texas, I could go in and give everybody a notice, and 60 days later I can raise the rent to whatever I feel is the right rent level. As long as they don't have a lease saying that, you know, their rent is $90 for the next 2 years, you're perfectly able to do that. So, you know, that's something you would definitely check in your due diligence on buying the park, is you want to review all those leases if there are any.
Right, and make sure that someone doesn't have a 3-year lease where you can't raise the rent for 3 more years or something, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And there are cases where, you know, people have that type of stuff, or you know, sometimes you have to give people, you know, every year a year lease. You can't do month to month. But typically what we do is we do our first lease is a year or less, and then we go month to month after that. We don't really want to tie them into, you know, just in case you want to get rid of them for some reason, you don't really want to sign a long-term lease if you don't have to.
Right. You're saying that the lease benefits the tenant more than the landlord, right?
Well,
in most cases.
Typically the lease, you know, the tenant, I think really in most real estate, especially the affordable, lower income type real estate, if they're not going to pay you and they want to walk a lease of a year, they're going to walk anyways. They don't really care. I mean, they're going to move out in the middle of the night.
Right. It's just you just make them think they've got a commitment, but it doesn't.
Right.
Yeah, they're just going to walk anyway.
So you really want to write it to benefit you as the landlord.
Dave, before you go, we want people to get the product. They can get the home study course. They can sign up for the bootcamp at jasonhartman.com and find out the dates and all of that stuff. But talk, if you would, about acquisition strategies. As you are certainly familiar, the big problem we've got in today's economy is lack of financing. There's a real shortage of financing out there. What can people do to acquire these parks in the current economy we're in today?
Well, you know, first of all, mobile home parks, of all the other real estate classes, they have usually can buy them at a higher cap rate, which is great because they actually have cash flow. By having that higher cap rate, it actually opens up a lot of other opportunities as far as you could borrow money at a higher interest rate and still be able to afford to make your mortgage payment. So, you know, that's kind of an inherent benefit of mobile home parks. But with most of the parks that I'm buying, I think I've got 7 parks right now under contract, and out of 7, 5 of those are owner financing with, you know, anywhere from 10% to 20% down, and they're financing the whole deal. And then I've got a couple that one is actually we're going to get a bank loan. It's an REO that we're buying, but we have a bank already set up to do a loan with 25% down. And then the last property we're buying is a local bank financing, and that's also with 25% down. So as far as buying parks, you know, obviously the first place to look is if the seller can actually sell or finance, they have an assumable note, or they own a free and clear. And a lot of the sellers that you're buying from do own the parks free and clear because they built them 20 or 30 years ago, and, you know, they paid them off, so they can actually finance, and, you know, it's actually a better position for them to take is finance and get 7% on their money rather than pay all the capital gains and to get in at on a CD at 2%. So,
but they really are willing to do the seller financing as much as they used to, because I would think they want to be cashed out. Maybe they want to look at other deals, other investments, or are they just senior citizens that the only thing they're really going to do is buy some stupid bonds or stick it in the bank or a CD?
That's it. That's what they're doing. They're not really investing in something else. They're retiring. Most of the sellers are mid-60s. The oldest person I bought one was like 91 years old. So,
well, see,
I'm in that age group.
I'm surprised a 91-year-old actually would be motivated to carry a note. Wouldn't they want all their cash knowing they don't have that many years left and they want to have control of that money?
Well, actually, what happened with him was this was a couple years ago when you could do seconds. So we did a new bank first, and then he carried a second of, it was 70% first and a 25% second. And then we refinanced about a year later and paid him off. But usually what we have to do with the sellers is give them a balloon payment type of deal. Maybe it's a 3-year or a 5-year call. If you try to structure a fully amortizing loan with somebody that's 70 years old at 30 years, they're not going to usually go for it. So you got to entice them with that balloon payment. You as the investor always want to have a longer balloon just in case rates go up or whatever, but you can typically negotiate a 5 to 7 year type of balloon right now.
Yeah, so what's your exit strategy there, though, ultimately to either sell the park or get bank financing to exit out of that balloon payment?
Typically, as long as you're running it right, you should be appreciating and you'll have great books and records. And we don't know where the banks are going to be at in 5 years, but I'm pretty certain they'll at least be better than they are today. It can't get much worse.
In any mature industry, what I'm sure a lot of our listeners are thinking is that there has been a significant amount of sophistication has been brought to the mobile home park business with people like you and others that I know out there acquiring properties that are more sophisticated. They're doing it as a real business, and it's less mom and pop-ish than it used to be. So the thing people might be thinking is, are all the deals kind of picked over out there, or are there still good opportunities for new investors to get into this business?
There definitely are less deals left today than there were, say, 10 years ago when everybody was buying parks because, they were just going crazy. But no, there are lots of deals. And what you have now is you have a lot of these mom and pops that are getting to that ripe age where they're ready to sell and retire. So probably, 35 to 45% of the parks out there are still owned by these moms and pops, and they're not going to keep them for another 20 years. They're going to be selling over the next 5 years or sooner. I actually just went and looked at a deal. I mean, as far as are there deals, I was just out in Kansas looking at a deal. It was 73 spaces with 52 occupied lots, and this was owned by mom and pop. And they called and said, "We want to sell the park. We're tired of it." And I said, "How much do you want?" They said $120,000. So I went out there, under $2,000 a lot, but 50, occupied. I mean, it's just an incredible deal.
By the way, is there a sort of a price per lot metric that you use? Of course, it depends where, I know, but
yeah, it really depends on the rent. But if you're looking at, say, $100 a month rent, your price per lot would probably be around $5,000. If you're at 200, you're more in the $10,000 range, and then it kind of balloons after that. So at 300, it might be 20,000. So as you get higher rent, your expense ratio gets lower. So you're going to balloon up. But usually, as an investor, I'm not looking for the $50,000 a lot parks. I'm looking for the stuff that's in the $5,000 to $15,000 per lot range, because that's really where the most opportunity is. That's still the affordable housing. That's not in Los Angeles or Denver, somewhere where, the rents are just high and everybody wants to buy those parks. When you buy in parks with rents in the 150 to 200 range, you can see those rents going up, you can see those going to 250 over time. But when you're buying parks at 500, it's going to be harder to get that rent up to, 600.
And when you say that lot rent, do you mean occupied lots or vacant lots? Because in every park, it's usually a combination of both.
Right. Yeah. You're looking at, typically, you're looking at occupied lots. So if it's a 100-space park and there's 50 occupied and the rent's 200, you want to be buying that for about $10,000 per lot for the occupied lots. And the vacant lots, you want to be valuing at like $1,000 or less per lot. Because unoccupied lots right now cost you money. They don't make you money because you have to mow them and keep the utilities up and pay the taxes on them and all that type of stuff. So when you're looking at the overall cap rate and cash on cash, those vacant lots are not worth anything. It's all based on those occupied lots.
And when we talk about the acquisition strategies, as we were, seller carryback is obviously great if you can get it. Bank financing, if you can get it, which is, I mean, is bank financing out there at all anymore?
You know, it was really easy to get bank financing 2 or 3 years ago on parks. Right now, you pretty much have to go to local banks and prepare a really good business package, business loan package, and that's something that you get with the Home Study course, by the way. It's about a 30-page loan package that kind of educates the banker on the park business. But no, you just have to beat the pavement. You know, when I first started, it's kind of like it was now, like it is now. You know, when I first started in the business, banks thought mobile home parks, oh, that's nasty, I don't want to loan on that. But then they started seeing that mobile home park loans are, you know, one of their best performing asset types. And I've talked to several lenders, you know, like Wells Fargo, and they, they say that that's their best performing asset type still. They have very few REOs on mobile home parks. It's held true for, you know, for over the last 30 years. They're just one of the best types of assets to loan on because they do cash flow, and, you know, that's a real important thing in real estate.
Right. On the acquisition strategy, so that's sort of the actual buying of the park. What are your thoughts on the master lease type arrangement, which is becoming pretty common, where people can't get financing, the seller's got financing on the property, so you can't get them to carry back, or at least not all of it, and maybe the bank loan is not assumable. What do you do then? A master lease, right?
Yeah, you pretty much have to do some type of master lease or sell the LLC or something like that. And no, it's becoming more common. I've actually been looking at doing some of those type of deals myself because, I mean, it's really a no lose for the buyer because they can go in and improve the property, get it to where it should be so that it is ready for bank financing down the road. So, you know, I think that, you know, the biggest caution is there on the master lease is to really read the existing loan documents because a lot of times they have provisions in there saying that you cannot do that type of lease.
It would call a due on sale clause is what you're
right,
getting at, right?
Due on sale or due on transfer of 50% of the LLC or, you know, that type of stuff. But no, it's a great way to do it. And, you know, on some of the, I would say, more poorly performing parks or parks that are over leveraged or, you know, borrowers in trouble for other assets that they own or, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, thing is, you know, master leases are great. I mean, definitely would want to do those, you know, as long as you don't want to overpay still, but, you know, as long as the terms work out, you know, definitely go for it.
Dave, we've got to wrap up, but give us another tip on seller financing, if you would.
Sure, Jason. One of the really biggest things about seller financing, and this is not what you're going to get from a bank, is you can get seller financing at better rates, better terms, and, you know, the big thing is it's non-recourse typically. So, you know, if you do buy a park and you make a mistake, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, you'd walk the deal, but if the economy keeps tanking and, you know, everything goes wrong, you're in there non-recourse. So that's really a big item on seller financing.
So non-recourse meaning that the seller can only come after the park as their collateral, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Just like, you know, your loan on your own home, your personal home, they can only go after the home, not after you.
Yeah, and I just want to make the disclaimer that that's mostly true, not always. It depends where,
yeah, that's
and,
true.
You know, if it's purchase
yeah.
money or not. Now, you've been kind enough to extend a special offer to our listeners. Do you want to tell everybody a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so for everybody that goes to jasonhartman.com and, you know, purchases the product, what we're going to do is we're going to throw in two free quick deal reviews, two extra ones. There's already two that are included with the course, but we're going to give you those. So if your first two deals don't work out, and you need some extra eyes on a couple other deals, we'll throw those in. And plus what we'll do is we'll throw in a copy of our loan package to buy parks. You know, we send that out to the banks and try to entice them on the actual business itself. And finally, we'll throw in what we call the early access. And what that is we send out a bunch of mobile home parks, you know, that come into our network that are for sale. And so we send those out to people that are looking to buy parks, and those go out to you via email. There's usually 2 to 3 every single day, and you'll get that for one full year. So we'll be actually sending you deals while you're going through the course and learn how to do it.
Fantastic. Well, excellent. Well, thank you so much for that kind and generous additional bonus there. We appreciate it. What else should people know in closing?
I think, you know, right now is really, as a buyer, you need to be out there pounding the pavement looking for these deals, because with the bank problems out there, there's a lack of financing. You know, that's when, you know, the best deals come about. People want to sell, and they're going to have to discount their price to get the deal done. And, you know, with mobile home parks, they are the affordable real estate. That's where people, you know, they're not going to move up into, you know, houses and luxury townhomes right now. They're moving down, and so your occupancies are going to grow. You're going to, you know, have great demand, because those people you're renting to are not really losing their jobs like everybody else is. Because they always can get a job at Walmart or Taco Bell or, you know, or that $8 to $10 an hour type of work. So, and that's who your tenants will be.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks for the insights, and I hope everybody will go to the website and get your products and look at what you have to offer. It's all there at jasonhartman.com. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you, Jason. It was a pleasure being on today.
Now you can get Jason's Creating Wealth in Today's Economy Home Study Course. All the knowledge and education revealed in a 9-hour day of the Creating Wealth Bootcamp, created in a home study course for you to dive into at your convenience. For more details, go to jasonhartman.com. Copyright the Hartman Media Company. For publication rights and interviews, please email media@jasonhartman.com. This show offers very general information concerning real estate for investment purposes. Opinions of guests are their own. Jason Hartman is acting as president of Platinum Properties Investor Network exclusively. Nothing contained herein should be considered personalized, personal, financial, investment, legal, or tax advice. Every investor's strategy and goals are unique. You should consult with a licensed real estate broker or agent or other licensed investment, tax, and/or legal advisor before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed. Please call 714-820-4200 and visit www.jasonhartman.com for additional disclaimers, disclosures, and questions.